We're working hand in glove with the White House. We meet with them constantly, daily. We worked on this bill together. We jointly drafted this legislation, House, Senate, and White House. So we are working on this together. The president's all in on this. Mike Pence is coming to our conference.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was House Speaker Paul Ryan, once again, pushing back against the Affordable Care Act and trying to rally support for the American Health Care Act, Republicans' bill. Republicans' health bill is under attack everywhere you look this week. It's not polling well. A poll out Wednesday morning said that it was supported by just 24% of Americans. It's facing resistance on the Hill, not just from Democrats, but from moderate and conservative Republicans, too. And a new score from the Congressional Budget Office, which predicted that 24 million fewer people would have coverage in a decade if the Republican health bill takes effect, is scaring more lawmakers away. So what happens next, and what are the issues that lawmakers are wrestling with? Normally, we balance liberals and conservatives on this podcast. Washington's weird weather got in the way this week, but we do have a great interview with Representative Joe Kennedy from Massachusetts. It's a chance to hear from a rising Democrat whose national profile went up after last week's epic all-night markups. Republicans called them stunts, Democrats called them a rallying cry, and tens of millions of people saw clips of Joe Kennedy rallying to fight for the Affordable Care Act and push back against the Republican bill. We'll talk about that and his healthcare priorities in a moment. But first, a reminder, if you like Pulse Check, help us keep it. You can rate us on your favorite podcast app. Please tell your friends and your colleagues, especially if you work in healthcare, that this podcast exists. And with that, here's Representative Joe Kennedy. Last week, the committee markups went 27 hours. How many hours were you awake?
I was awake for, I think, all of it. I tried to sneak out at one point to catch a nap between votes, and I literally got rested my head down on a pillow, and 2 minutes later, they called a vote. So there was one of those votes. I was the last person named in the roll call, and that was because I raced back in just to make sure that I my vote was counted at the last second. So other than those 2 minutes, which I don't think I actually fell asleep, I was there for all of it.
Did you try to sleep in this office?
Or
the hideaway?
Their little hideaway place that I tried. Didn't, again, not successful. And then after that, kind of infused with coffee, and then shortly thereafter, morning breakfast of McDonald's, which apparently I just found out that our committee staff spent over $300 on Egg McMuffin sandwiches and hash browns, which is tough to do at McDonald's, but that's one box that we have checked, and I hope we never check again.
Was the coffee from McDonald's? Was it Dunkin' Donuts coffee?
I don't know
where
the coffee was from, but I had a lot of it. And, you know, look, for the first 24 hours, for the first bit of that anyway, you're kind of going on adrenaline and kind of, you know, obviously paying very close attention to the debate, and then you kind of lag for a second, then you get a second wind, and then that third wind was kind of struggling, and then I got through the morning fine, and then kind of, I guess, late morning, I was starting to struggle a bit, at which point it was nice. A couple of senators had sent over a whole nother round of food and a lot more coffee. Senator Steny Hoyer came by, House Minority Whip had come by and dropped off a whole bunch of food and coffee. And so at that point, if it wasn't caffeinated, I wasn't drinking it. So it kept us going. I wish I could say it powered us through to victory, but
well,
so it goes.
We'll talk about what exactly that accomplished, but I did watch along. Luckily, I was at home in my PJs for most of it. There are moments, though, when congressmen have been going that long that the scripting falls away a bit and becomes more natural. Joe Barton is teasing you about talking too fast. You're kind of joking back. It's a very human side to the congressman at 3:30 in the morning.
It is. And look, there's we obviously have some profound philosophical differences. One of the hardest parts of this job, but I think for folks that do this well, is separating those philosophical differences from your personal relationships, understanding that if you can't separate those, it's actually very hard to get through some of the challenges that this job brings you. If you didn't care passionately about the policies and the laws undergirding the foundation of this of our society, you wouldn't be in this job. It's literally what we do, and it takes an awful lot to to keep, get the job and keep the job. So people that are here actually really care. You might care about different things, but they care. And understanding that the things that drive me to want to do this job and serve are going to be different reasons that drive some of my Republican colleagues. And that's fine. But also understanding that the reasons that some of them run for office are to directly oppose the things that I want to do. And that's the part that sometimes gets hard on the issues that you really care about that are personal to you, that you see other people just cannot grasp or will not grasp or see it in a fundamentally different way, to somehow then be able to separate the policy from the person. And that can be really hard and really hard at certain times. At times, though, that humanity does break through. And we had some contentious moments in that hearings. You also had some very human ones where after sitting down at those desks for that long, look, Republicans got tired just like Democrats did. And so it does, the formality of it does strip aside sometimes.
There were some moments that went epically viral from across the night on the other side, some that didn't go viral mm-hmm. for maybe happy reasons for the congressman, Jason Smith, the Missouri Republican. Maybe you saw this talking about taxing the sun and taxing ice cream.
You know what? If you look at the number one cause of skin cancer, it's not tanning beds. Do a Google search. It's the sun. So why have they not proposed a tax on the sun?
And then your own moments went about as viral as anything, too, talking about mental health and Planned Parenthood. How conscious are you when it is happening, even at 2 or 3 in the morning, that you are on camera and that these moments can blow up?
Conscious that you're on camera, try to be so that you don't do something too stupid. Conscious that it will blow up, no idea. If somebody had told me that what was going to go viral was the details of Medicaid policy and essential health benefits at 2 in the morning or 4 in the morning, I would have laughed and said, you're out of your mind. Now, apparently, I don't really understand the internet because it's the last thing.
You understand the internet. You're a millennial. It's in your
blood.
Barely.
I had no idea that was going to get the resonance that it did. And, you know, I think when it comes to going viral to that extent, it's hard. It's a hard thing to actually orchestrate. People have said, hey, you should do that again. And, yeah, if I knew what that was the first time, I would have done it before. It wasn't. I think what happened in those instances and others was something that was very real and very organic. And when it came to at least that moment, something that I care an awful lot about, and ensuring that people have access to mental health care and behavioral health care, and critically important that people understand that this bill, as currently written, strips that from millions and millions of people.
On Medicaid, on specifically.
Medicaid, yes.
Not on the broader bill, though
no.
We may see changes to essential health benefits from Tom Price down the line.
Yes.
So just looking at that moment specifically where you're pushing the Republican lawyer mm-hmm. on mental health benefits.
Up to the states to actually impose. So when we look at those essential health benefits, whether it's mental health care or potentially for other health conditions, that is no longer essentially covered or required to be covered by this version of this text. Is that not correct?
The text before us does remove the application of the essential health benefits for the alternative benefit plans in Medicaid.
Is that the most important point you feel like you made across those hours and hours of markup?
I think that was a critically important point because I think, look, this is one of the challenges when you have any piece of legislation that is going to rewrite a seismic portion, not only of our economy and roughly $3 trillion a year, but something that touches every single person in our country, right? At some point in your life, you are going to need healthcare, right? Whether that's the moment you're born, which yes, you're going to then, or the moment we pass, and probably a lot of times in between, you're going to need this. And so whether it's for you personally or for a loved one, this is something we all, as Americans, as humans, are going to rely on. So it is an immensely personal bill to begin with. We have huge philosophical differences on how to deliver that care and the government's role in it. And I think it's critically important to point out the differences that some of my Republican colleagues are taking with this bill philosophically than the ones that I believe we should take. And fundamentally for me, healthcare is about how we treat people in their time of need, understanding that we all at some point are going to be in that time of need. And so I care about your well-being and the health of you and your family because at some point, I hope that you would care about me and mine. And that exchange is, that is very real, and it's, that's not unique to American society, but that's I think, a central part of who we are as a country, the fact that we're willing to make that commitment to one another. And this bill philosophically destroys that premise, and it destroys that promise. And so I tried at a number of points to point out how this bill fundamentally fails that commitment that we make. One of them, very clearly and written directly in the law, so not trying to peel through incentives or how the bill sets up various structures, but directly in the law, page 8, line 3, cuts it for essential health benefits for the Medicaid expansion population in the end or the beginning of 2020. And that's not just mental health care. That's a whole wide variety of other programs. But for a population, roughly 11 million people, who need access to those benefits. And that moment, I think, critically important, but a critically important piece to a much larger message of saying this bill is a massive transformation of the promise of healthcare in this country and how healthcare, how we think about it. And I think, I'd hope that that point got across as well. It's something I want to continue to keep speaking out about because that's something that people need to know.
Interestingly, there are some conservatives who say it's not enough of a transformation, that it's too much of keeping the Affordable Care Act. Though, to your point, there are not just the changes to mental health benefits and other benefits for Medicaid population. There's the defunding of Planned Parenthood for a year, which you spoke out about, too. You made a point, I think it was about 2:30 in the morning, because I was watching and I flagged this, and in about 15 seconds boiled down the Democratic argument, which was, we're moving too fast on this. Why are we not even waiting for the CBO score? Mm-hmm. CBO score comes out this week. To paraphrase the president, it's a disaster. There are 24 million people who would less who would have coverage under this bill. What difference do you think it would have made had the CBO score been known last week?
So CBO score was critically important for a number of reasons. We can point to the 24 million people that are going to lose health insurance that would have had it under the Affordable Care Act that don't now, or the total of 56 million down the road. You can look at the fact that it cuts $880 billion from Medicaid, which is the way that not only is the biggest payer of mental health services that we've talked about already in that country, it's also the biggest payer of long-term care services in the country.
Right? But to your, and to your point, there's such a difference because to you, that is a horrible cut. And to Republicans I've talked to, that's great. They're cutting back on the Medicaid spending.
Cutting Medicaid spending, cutting government spending is one thing. Cutting the means by which our parents and grandparents can age with dignity in the golden years of their life is something that I actually don't think most Americans celebrate. Government spending, sure. What this means and how they cut government spending, I don't think so. And so CBO, Congress gets so wrapped up in these scores and these projections and the rest of it. My point that I tried to make throughout that hearing was that, look, those numbers are valid, right? And yes, I think it would have been great to have those numbers beforehand because I'd ask my colleagues, how do you square the fact that you're taking healthcare away from 24 million people and their families? That's a very real thing, a very real thing. But behind those spreadsheets and those numbers and those line items are people's lives. People's lives, like my intern who was there for a little while that had her life saved twice by the Affordable Care Act when
I've
she got
heard
cancer
you speak on that.
Twice.
Yeah.
And so the idea that this is something that is just, oh, we're going to break Medicaid population into different sectors and we're going to cap it and, you know, we're going to put that to the states and the states can do that. Phooey. That's not what this is about. This is about how we care for and treat those in their time of need in our country and the commitment that our government is going to make to them, understanding that at some point we will all be there. And to hear our colleagues say, look, we're going to introduce choice and freedom into this. The only freedom you're introducing is your ability to choose between your mortgage and your medication. That's not choice. That's devastating for families that are in need of trying to meet both of those demands. And so I don't like this bill.
No, you hate this bill. It's fair to say that passion comes through now. I've heard it over the past week and from your colleagues too. But real question here, you are in the minority party. Your party can't stop this. This is now on Republicans and Republicans deciding whether or not they're going to stick with this bill or not. What did that epic markup in your committee, in the Ways and Means Committee, ultimately accomplish?
We can't stop this bill, on the one hand, you're right, because we don't have the Democrats alone don't have the votes for it. We can help stop this bill by ensuring that, to the best extent we can, the American public understands the consequences of what this bill will mean for them and their families. And if they do understand it, and I would like to think that those hearings helped force through some of those details, if they do understand it, I don't think they're going to support it. Because I do think that, well, plenty of folks out there will say, yes, we need to cut government spending. Cutting government spending on the backs of the working families, particularly in rural communities, who this bill will disproportionately hurt, I don't think is a commitment that American public wants to make. And so, while we can't stop it with votes, you can make sure that those voices are heard. And once people do understand that the doctors have come out against it, hospitals have come out against it, nurses have come out against it, faith communities come out against it, seniors have come out against it, the only people for this are a couple members in Washington and their leadership, and that's it.
So you see your role as a megaphone, essentially, for these concerns. And you specifically, this has been a big moment. Since I reached out to your office a week ago, I've seen you on national TV. Nancy Pelosi and others have blessed you. What is it like in this moment right now? Is this going to be a signature platform issue for you?
Look, it's an important issue for me, right? No doubt about it. But it's been an important issue before, and it will be an important issue going forward. When you talk about something like healthcare, one of these foundational and structural pieces to our society, to our economy, to our country, you're never going to get it wholly right. Not only are you going to come into the philosophical concerns about it, times change. We develop new cures. Delivery systems evolve. Like we recognize that part of our system needs to continually get updated, and government's role in it has to adjust. So you're never going to wholly get this right. You can make it open and transparent and fair and more equitable. And the system we have at the moment is not open and transparent and fair and equitable. It's more fair and equitable under the Affordable Care Act than it has been before. This bill takes us back to a place that is devastating, again, for so many families across the country. And, you know, to add insult to injury out of this, the idea that at the same time and under the same text that you cut $880 billion for health care for families that are working paycheck to paycheck, you pass a massive tax break for the wealthy is just insulting. It just, when you're talking about healthcare, and again, that care that we give each other in need, the idea that you're somehow finding a way to cut their access to care to give the rich a tax break just doesn't square with what the intent of healthcare is supposed to be. That this ends up being not a healthcare bill, it's a tax bill disguised as healthcare.
Hey, it's Dan Diamond, and we'll get back to the interview with Joe Kennedy in just a moment. But I wanted to tell you about an event coming up on March 21st, Tuesday, in the morning at the Newseum in Washington, D.C., Politico's Outside In. It's our series of events and talks on digital health. We have a great lineup for Tuesday, the 21st. David Shulkin, the VA secretary, Anish Chopra, the health IT evangelist who you've heard on this podcast and more, will be in conversation with a couple of us moderating panels. I will be one of those folks. We'd love to see you too. You can find the information about the event on politico.com/events. And with that, let's get back to the interview with Joe Kennedy. I think the most cliched question to ever ask you is about your family name. And this has been plumbed extensively. There is a great New York Times Magazine piece about your running for office. But there really is a healthcare connection in the Kennedy family.
Yeah.
President Kennedy laid the groundwork for Medicare and Medicaid. Your great-uncle, both mm-hmm. great-uncles, great-uncle Ted Kennedy, chair of the HELP Committee and was a key advocate for coverage expansion. Is healthcare on the list of policy priorities for you? Is it number one? Is it in the top three?
Look, it's a critical piece for me, absolutely. Because I look, and I don't look at this as kind of saying, hey, if you happen to be a member of my family, you care about healthcare. But I do think it just stems from a point of saying, if you believe that government's role is to try to address, listen to the concerns of your constituents and address those worries and those fears as best you can, one of those consistent worries and fears is healthcare. It's how do I provide for my family when somebody gets sick or if I can't? And how do we make sure that anybody in this country, if a loved one falls ill, is going to do everything they can to try to make sure that person gets the best care that they need. Any parent is going to do that for the child, Democrat, Republican, young, old, rich, poor, black, white, no matter what. It's just, it's a human response to somebody that you love. The fact is that, look, we can never get to a place where somebody says, look, you're providing equal care. No, but you can get to a point where you can say, we're providing you quality, access to quality, affordable health care to make sure that you're getting the best possible care that the richest nation in the world should be able to deliver. And we're not there yet. You look at the difference and disparities of health outcomes between ethnicity and demographics and wealth and particularly urban poor and rural poor. We could be doing an awful lot better. And so when you go around and you talk to people and you hear their concerns and you understand about the framework in our society and how I think government's response is to try to make sure that that framework creates a playing field where every single person has a chance to make the most out of their own talent and hard work and their determination. Everybody gets a fair shot. Healthcare is a critically important piece to that.
I noticed how you avoided the family and then went really big. That's a good political skill that will serve you well, already has served you well. You've been elected 3 times to Congress. You come from a safe mm-hmm. district. Do you feel like you have the room that if Republicans, this bill dies, mm-hmm. and right now there are serious challenges facing it, but Republicans want to do some smaller scale health reform, mm-hmm. could you see yourself crossing the aisle and supporting it?
Look, so I kind of come at this from a special place, not for any other reason other than representing Massachusetts, where we've got a 3.4% unemployment rate. You've got a 2.8% uninsured rate. You've had a commitment.
Thanks in part now, to Governor Mitt Romney.
Governor Mitt Romney, Governor Baker, and a number of Republican governors. Yeah. That have consistently tried to make health care work. And, you know, with a Democratic legislature, had a bipartisan commitment, not just politically, but with the advocacy community, with hospitals, with doctors, with patient groups, with the insurance industry, coming together to say, we need to get this right, understanding that you're never going to get perfect, but we can actually address these concerns in a very real way to get to a good space. We've got a number of health insurers that are offering our product. We've got a good product that is offered. You've got the highest rate of coverage in the entire country. We've got some challenges on costs, but and particularly for small businesses, but we're making a lot better progress than the rest of the country. So when you hear the criticisms of some of my colleagues, I hear those, and I have no doubt that when they hold up those binders and say, I've got stories of how this law has failed, I don't doubt the fact that you've got stories. I've also got plenty of stories to show you how this law has succeeded. And I know how you can actually make this law work if there is a commitment to do so. So when I think of it, yes, there's a number of areas that we need to strengthen and under the Affordable Care Act, particularly for small businesses. There's stories out there, obviously, of premiums going high and deductibles being too high. We need to address it. We need to find ways to address, which the ACA has done, which I think my Republican colleagues ignore, you know, that they said no mandate, but they have a huge penalty in there if you do let insurance
lapse. The new 30% surcharge is in some ways just like the mandate. It could be as unpopular as the mandate has
it
become.
It's as unpopular, and it's, I think, structured to such that only folks that get really sick will then pay that penalty, get back in under covered under insurance. And not to mention that just the philosophical difference here of saying somehow paying a tax to the government on the front end is tyranny, but a fine to an insurance company is freedom, which is a fundamental piece that I just don't understand. But we heard an awful lot about rhetoric around freedom and choice from our colleagues over those 28 hours that just, from my perspective, you're paying a fine or paying a tax, you're still paying money out of your pocket. You want a better product for it. And there's no evidence that this is going to lead to a better product.
You really do need to hear the Missouri Republican on taxing the sun and taxing ice cream, because he illustrates in some ways the tax thoughts. I know your time is precious, so maybe if we can close with a
Please.
Lightning round, I will ask relatively quick questions with quicker answers.
Yeah.
We've talked a bit about why the ACA has worked so well. What is the biggest problem with the ACA right now?
I think, one, it depends on where you are, right? So we've got, there's no doubt that it's got challenges in particular, particularly Republican districts across the country. Democrats, I think, need to do a better job of recognizing that those stories are real and finding ways to address them. Republicans also have to acknowledge that some of those challenges are because they have deliberately sabotaged the effective implementation of this law. Until we can get to that point of understanding that those stories are real, but there's things that both sides can do to address them, you continue in this really challenging political environment.
I tweeted out some videos of you. I got that sounded weird, so let me clarify. I tweeted out videos of you talking about healthcare in the middle of that markup. I got responses, this guy should run for president. Again, there's been all this national attention. It's been a breakthrough moment for you. Do you understand why that is? As honestly as you can.
No, I don't. And look, I care about this issue. I'm thrilled that people understand that I care about this issue, and I'm thrilled that people are understanding that there's some real challenges with this law. Look, if I could have guessed that some of those moments would have gotten the viewership that they would have, I would have tried to have done it a long time ago. That's not... At no point during any of that could I have imagined that this was going to be something that would resonate, whether it's talking about women's health at 2 a.m. or 4 a.m. or Medicaid benefits at 4 a.m.
That's prime time for social content.
Most folks don't think that's the stuff that goes viral. I certainly didn't.
A few months ago, I had former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle on this podcast. We talked about young rising Democrats. I talked to Henry Waxman about the same, because the party has skewed somewhat older. In your view, who is a rising Democrat under the age of 50 who could be a national leader to focus on? Can't say yourself as a bailout.
No, I think that there's actually a number of them. I'm happy to bang through a quick list for you. But I think one of the myths at the moment is that there's no bench in the Democratic Party. I think there's a huge bench. There just hasn't been a huge, a great space for them to elevate their voices. So
let's rattle off some names.
One, Beto O'Rourke. Two, Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend and former candidate for the DNC. Eric Garcetti, mayor of L.A. Julian Castro and Joaquin Castro, colleagues of mine, Tulsi Gabbard, Eric Swalwell, a number of my colleagues here, some colleagues in the Senate too. Chris Murphy obviously has a very bright future in front of him. Cory Booker. You're going to get me into a bit of a challenge of remembering the ages of some of my Senate colleagues. So I'll throw a couple in that list too of Amy Klobuchar, but I'm not sure where she falls. It's
never offensive to assume that someone is younger than older.
There you go.
So some of the folks that you named, though, are in red states, like Mayor Pete. Yep. Where does he go from here? Some of the Texas representatives that you mentioned, Texas has been reddish for a long time. Can the Democratic Party rise if these folks don't have the same path that you do as a liberal from the Northeast to national office?
Absolutely they can. And I think, look, one is giving them an opportunity to tell their stories and to put forth a vision for the country and how they would choose to lead. And I think, yes, there's some structural challenges of politics in those states, but you've also got some pretty exceptional people that care and that are willing to do the hard work to show folks that they care and that have unique visions for how they can make government work for their communities. And if you do that, when push comes to shove, this is about people. And there is no substitute at all, period, to knocking on somebody's door, shaking their hand, looking in their eye, and asking them what's on their mind and what you can do to help. And I think as long as anybody, Democrat or Republican, keeps that in mind, they're going to do well. It doesn't matter if you're in a red state or blue state or otherwise. If you come up with the policies that are best address their concerns with a credibility that you can deliver and a humbleness to know that you don't have all the answers, I think you're going to do great. And I think they will.
Who's your favorite Republican?
I actually have a couple of them. There's a group of us that get together in the morning to actually work out in the gym. Mark Wayne Mullen's one of those that his name came up in
the Oklahoma
hearing a bit of Oklahoma. Jason Smith's actually part of that group as well, so I look forward to actually hearing his comments from the Ways and Means Committee. There's a couple of others in that group that's there most mornings as well. And look, I've got I'd like to think anyway, I've got a pretty good relationship with a number of folks on the Republican side of the aisle. Again, doing my best to separate the politics from the policy. There's probably a couple names out there that if I throw out, they'll get primaried. And some legitimately.
Totally mention them. That makes this podcast that much more newsworthy.
I will refrain from a couple of them, but suffice it to say, look, part of this is making sure that if you find somebody that you disagree with 99 things out of 100, fine. Find the one thing that you agree on and celebrate that. And so there's an awful lot of folks out there that we have our differences on a number of different issues, but We've been able to come together on some other ones.
If you're spotting someone in the weight room, that person might be more likely to agree with you.
Yes, too. Exactly.
Last two questions quickly. You've been in Congress for 4 years in the House. If your career doesn't move beyond the House, is it a success?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I don't think, I think if you're looking at success or failure in this, in public service as what title you have, it's the wrong way to think about public service, and you shouldn't be in the job, right? And I would like to think that I would be measured not by, I mean, yes, obviously bills you pass are part of it, but by lives that you're able to affect for the better. And you can do that in any office, whether that's a mayor or city councilor or president of the United States. You can do that if you pass laws or if you just listen to your constituents and try to make sure that the basic part of your job, which is constituent services, you do that right and you do that well. And that's a big focus for us and will continue to be.
Last question. We talk a lot about the ACA. The Republican health bill is now kind of taking up all the oxygen in the room. What is the healthcare issue that we should be talking about, but we're not?
I think a huge one still is and will continue to be mental and behavioral healthcare. This is such an important issue for so many families, obviously been highlighted a bit from an opioid epidemic that's struck so in such devastating ways for so many parts of the country. But that has ramifications, not just for those individuals, but in our, for mental behavioral health in our emergency rooms, because people don't get access care that they need, they end up getting taken to our emergency rooms. It drives up costs. It has huge impacts in our criminal justice system, which is where I first got exposed to it as a prosecutor in Massachusetts. Anecdotally, we'll tell you that if of the cases that I saw come in our lower court levels, district court in Massachusetts, a huge percentage of them anyway, were folks suffering from drug abuse, mental illness, or alcoholism. And if you could adequately and accurately address that, you could just drop those caseloads down precipitously. And so the safety net in so many ways for our criminal or for our mental health system has become our criminal justice system, which puts prosecutors in a terrible position of saying, yes, this person committed a crime, but they committed a crime because they're sick. They're breaking into homes to get money to feed an opioid addiction. Locking them away doesn't solve the problem of curing them from opiates. It just prolongs the problem. And when they come back out, if they haven't gotten the treatment, they're going to go right back in. So structurally, that lack of investment from both the federal government and the state government in a mental, an adequate and humane mental behavioral health system would be a sea change for not just that aspect of our healthcare systems, but criminal justice and so many other aspects of our society would just, for those folks and those families that are suffering from it, be a massive change for the better.
And that is something where there might be bipartisan hope of cooperation. Republicans have talked a lot about the opioid issue. President Trump talked about it a lot during his campaign. Haven't seen much action yet, so.
Aside from a healthcare bill that strips people from access to care for opiates.
Well, we'll have to end on that note. Representative Joe Kennedy, a lacrosse player from Massachusetts. Thanks for making time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. Thanks again to Representative Joe Kennedy and his office for making time. Thank you to our ace producer, Bridget. For the record, I like Uber Mulcahy for tagging along. You can find Pulse Check on all of your favorite podcast apps. My favorite podcast app remains Overcast, but iTunes, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and others are all great too. Email me at ddiamond@politico.com if you have suggestions for who else you'd like to hear. And we'll be back with a new episode of Pulse Check next week.